Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, going to be your host today for Juneau Afternoon. Over the next hour, I've got some great guests lined up. Greg Cheney's going to come in, probably accompanied by Katie Bosler, to talk to us about the Empty Chair performance and film that's coming up tonight and tomorrow night out at the University of Alaska Southeast. Ray Lalonde, from UAF, is going to give us the a shellfish aquaculture talk Friday night, tonight, and he'll give us a preview of that. We're going to also be hearing from Sally Smith, who was interviewed earlier today by Jeff Brown, and the subject is the Holiday Pops concert, which is coming up. And Susan Smith will be here to talk about a display of wood carvings and robots over at the Arts Council Gallery, and an audio postcard from Scott Burton about tonight's poetry slam. So stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Sacagan Chippewa community is developing an emergency plan to prepare for natural disasters or other emergencies near Mole Lake in Wisconsin. WXPR's Natalie Jablonski reports.
The tribe has received a $45,000 grant from FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, to put together a task force, which met for the first time recently. Environmental Director and Task Force Member Tina Van Zyl says the tribe doesn't have much in place in terms of emergency management, and the plan will help coordinate existing agencies.
Let's say a tornado or something did hit the community. With this plan and these task force members, we would be educated. We would know what to do, what we're each responsible to do.
Van Zyl thinks the plan could identify weak areas in the tribe's potential response and could be the basis for future grant applications to improve programs or infrastructure.
Like if we want to get more EMTs or first responders, we hardly have any in our community. So that we already addressed that wow, we don't have enough trained people to be even first responders.
The task force will meet 3 more times and hopes to have a draft of the All Hazards Mitigation Plan by April.
That was Natalie Jablonski reporting. A Navajo language app recently made its debut. Other native language apps like Cherokee are helping in language preservation efforts. And as Polly Dinetclaw reports, the Navajo one is intended to help language speakers and learners.
Native Innovation, Inc., the creator of the Denebazod app, is a Native and military veteran-owned company dedicated to sustaining Navajo language and values, says Kyla Winters, the education technology specialist.
We wanted to contribute to the indigenous language initiative that's occurring around the world. Our language is sacred. It rebuilds our identity.
Winters says the idea for this native language app came last year after he spent several hours online looking for common situational Navajo phrases. He discovered several blogs and websites with Navajo language resources, but says they didn't offer what he wanted. So Winters created DineWeb 2.0, a blog dedicated to teaching Diné words and phrases, and later, development of the app. The app is like a dictionary. A user can look up Navajo and English words for their meaning and how they would be used. The user can also hear the word in Navajo. I'm Polly Dinetclaw.
An exhibit at the National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. examines treaties. It's designed to shed light on the complex history of the agreements between Native nations and the government, says Kevin Gover, the museum's director.
We make very clear throughout this exhibition that the Indians were understood as nation, and they maintain that status, and the treaties remain in effect.
Organizers say the exhibit, which took a decade to create, offers a never-before-seen look into the broken, kept, and renewed treaty obligations made by the U.S. It features artwork, signed treaties, and other significant historical objects. The exhibit runs through the fall of 2018. Navajo attorney Chris Stearns was recently elected chair of the Washington State Gambling Commission. According to the commission, he's the first Native American elected to the position. The 5-member group is a limited jurisdiction law enforcement agency devoted to gaming regulations, licensing, and enforcement. Comcast and NBC Universal is donating $5 million of advertising to the American Indian College Fund. PSAs will air next year on the cable system. The organization, which provides financial support for Native American higher education, is also receiving an in-kind cash donation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Science, technology, engineering, and math students thrive at New Mexico Tech. Personalized instruction, rigorous curricula, undergrad research opportunities. New Mexico Tech, where the smart kids go. Info in Winds of Change magazine or visit nmt.edu.
If you are a Native American, there's one simple thing you can do to help your elders, help young people seeking an education, and help develop Native business. Go out and vote on November 4th. Voting on Election Day makes a difference in Washington, D.C. and at home. Go to nativenews.net for more information. Brought to you by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
In a couple of seconds, it'll be 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. And my first guest is sort of a repeat guest, but he only comes on once in a while. And he tells these interesting stories. Greg Chaney is here. And the last time we talked to him, he had just released a documentary film called Journey on the Wild Coast, which basically told the story of two people who decided to coast Alaska in a very small boat. And it was kind of an interesting tale. So this one is also a fascinating story, and this is the story of the empty chair. Welcome, Greg.
Well, it's great to be here.
Thanks for having me. Now you can say that again, and I'll actually have you on the air.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Katie Bosler's with him from the University of Alaska Southeast, and she is here to tell us about the chance to see this fine film. Katie, welcome.
Yeah, so a couple repeat customers here, you know. We just have some interesting things to talk about.
Yeah. So let's see. Tonight, this is Empty Chair Weekend out at UAS, kind of, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're calling it. The thing's a little bit different this weekend and next weekend at UAS is we have a kind of a two-nighter, I'd call it. So tonight is the Living Voices presentation with the group from Seattle. We do have a representative from that theater group, and she'll be doing a kind of a dramatic interpretation of the story of the empty chair, which is, you know, John Tanaka was, I guess, a valedictorian. I know Greg can tell us more about this. During World War II, and his family was interred.
Yeah, Greg, can you give us enough background so we can understand what we're going to be seeing tonight and tomorrow?
Okay, well, I'm a little bit confused because I thought the Living Voices was going to be about the Seattle experience.
Is it? Okay.
That's my understanding. I haven't seen the performance.
Yeah.
But,
okay. Well, anyway.
It's within the silence. Basically, it's the internment experience,
yes,
which
exactly.
was where Tanaka spent the time.
Right. And that's what makes this such a fascinating story is the whole West Coast was declared as a war zone during World War II. Yeah. And the U.S. military decided that the safest thing to do was to take everybody of Japanese descent, or anyone who was from Japan, but someone who was born in the United States of Japanese heritage, and take all of those people and put them into camps so that they couldn't pose a threat in case the Japanese invaded. And so what happened was all along the West Coast, the Japanese Americans were rounded up and basically arrested and sent to internment camps. Which weren't a whole lot different than concentration camps in Germany, except that the United States didn't do anything particularly evil. It just kept everybody there and deprived them of their rights. Mm-hmm. What happened in Juneau is so unique because Juneau, the Alaskan story of the internment is almost unknown. Very few people talk about the internment. It wasn't a good subject of conversation for the Japanese Americans after the war. Most felt somehow ashamed that they had been subjected to this treatment. But the story doesn't get told very often. And I actually talked to Ken Burns before I started making this documentary, and he said, I asked him, do you have any advice? And he said, you're going to have to be very patient. This story is something that is culturally repressed. The people who experienced it don't want to talk about it. They are ashamed of it. You're going to have to gain their confidence, and it's going to be difficult. And so I'm like, great, what do I sign up for? But I got to know Mary and Alice Tanaka, That's their maiden names. They both have married names now. But they were born and raised in Juneau, and their brother, John Tanaka, in 1942 was the valedictorian of their graduating class of the high school. And so what happened was they were interned in April, and the...
And the real hero of this story now is the superintendent of schools.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of heroes.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing that's heartwarming about it. The McKinnon family, I think, are really amazing folks. They
yeah.
came forward and helped me with giving a lot of documents and photographs and things from the era. Their father, Sim McKinnon, was the one that was in charge of arresting these folks because he was the highest-ranking military officer in Juneau at the time. I mean, nobody knew this was going to happen. It was a surprise. But his son, Skip McKinnon, was best friends with John Tanaka.
Mm.
And so John Tanaka had been over at their house. They were you know, lifelong friends. They both were born and raised in Juneau. Well, actually, Skip McKinnon was born in the Philippines because he was a military family. They were moving around at that time. So oddly enough, the guy who was born in the Philippines was considered fine to stay here. But the guy who was born in Juneau, John Tanaka, because he had Japanese heritage, had to be sent away. So to skip to the event, they were all sent out. All the Japanese were sent out before the graduation. And as a result, the superintendent of schools, as you mentioned, as well as the rest of the school board, agreed to have an early graduation ceremony solely for John Tanaka. And then, and more amazingly, when the actual graduation ceremony happened in May, they set aside an empty chair on the stage for John Tanaka. And as a, you know, for us in this era, that may not seem very amazing. But what I tried to do with the documentary is take people back to that time.
Yeah.
And most people forget, in the beginning of World War II, the United States was losing. The entire United States forces surrendered in the Philippines. All of those men were taken and put in prisoner of war camps. 30% of those men died at the hands of the Japanese military. And so there wasn't a whole lot of sympathy for Japan in the United States at that point. And to be to stand with a Japanese American was considered very suspicious. But the people in Juneau recognized that John Tanaka was one of our own, and that this racism that was sweeping the nation was unjustified because they knew these people. And so they set aside that empty chair. There were no Japanese Americans known to be in Juneau at that time. And so it was an act of civil disobedience for that era. Now it doesn't seem so amazing. Back then it was a tremendous gesture. And then beyond that, and more to me almost as amazing, several prominent Juneau citizens wrote affidavits to the Attorney General of the United States and said that John Tanaka and the Tanaka family were loyal American citizens. They went on the record and sent those. That wasn't, nobody requested that. I mean, the Tanaka family, they knew needed help. But they sent those out hoping that it would make a difference. I don't know if it did or not, but then eventually the Japanese Americans were released. And when they came back to Juneau, there were people waiting on the dock for them
to welcome them back.
Right. And that is so different.
Yeah.
In like Oregon, there were
stole property from the
people
who were in
there. Was that whole episode. But when the Japanese were released, there were signs on the edge of town say, "We Japanese do not come back. We cannot guarantee your safety after dark."
Yeah.
And
that's fascinating. I had no idea.
Oh, it was horrible. And so the Juneau experience, you know, as dark as the whole chapter is of the internment, the Juneau story, it kind of gives you a little bit of faith in humanity.
Greg, I can't wait to see the film. And we get to see it tomorrow night at 7 o'clock up on at UAS. You're doing it in the big theater?
At the Egan Lecture Hall.
Egan Lecture Hall.
Egan
okay.
Lecture Hall, yeah.
Outstanding opportunity. Open to the public, free free admission.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But tonight we also get to see the Seattle group come up and basically do a dramatic interpretation of the internment experience, which would be the other end of what the Tanaka family was experiencing.
Right. right. And that's the one with Ruth Coughlin. And yesterday she was on with Steve McFeeters and Mary Tanaka talking about that event. But just we want to emphasize, we know that these are very fascinating stories, and that we do have a limited seating at the Egan Lecture Hall. And so the last-minute
be a good idea to swing up there a little early.
The Juno
tomorrow.
Thing, you might want to leave, tell yourself to leave 15 or try 20 minutes early.
20 minutes
early. Greg, now this is only the second time this film has been shown in Juno, is that correct?
Well, actually, it's the third time. The first time we showed it in the 20th century, and that was great. It was almost full. Then we showed it at the Goldtown Nickelodeon, and we turned about 40 people away.
Oh, my
that,
gosh. Wow.
And it was standing room only. So I don't want to turn people away tonight. I'd like people to get there early. Hopefully we can find everybody a seat. And tomorrow night. I'm not.
Outstanding. Greg, thank you so much for the summary and for everything else. It's a terrific story. I don't know exactly how to make this transition, but there's another great event coming up next Friday.
Right. Well, this is what I want to clarify for people. Is Evening at Egan's usually just Friday nights at 7 o'clock. But this weekend, we have, of course, the Living Voices presentation tonight at 7. Tomorrow night is Greg's film, both Egan Lecture Hall, 7 o'clock. Free to the public. Get there early. And then next weekend, we do have the annual Fall Forum with the Juno World Affairs Council and the University of Alaska Southeast. This one is entitled Mexico and the U.S. Do Fences Make Good Neighbors? That's going to start on Thursday afternoon. And there's an all-star cast coming into town to give presentations on the subject of Mexico and the U.S., international relations. But I do want to let you know that the Friday event, Evening at Egan, we're very excited about it because we're going to be hosting a filmmaker, Yolanda Cruz. She's going to another film. So you know, I think you'll be interested in this, Greg. She'll be presenting her film, 2,501 Migrants, and that's the story of a sculptor who creates 2,501 life-size sculptures as an homage to a mass exodus from his home village. So this explores questions of art, indigenous community, global migration, and it is in Zapoteco, which is an indigenous language spoken in Oaxaca with Spanish and English subtitles. So that's 7 o'clock next Friday, the 24th, at the Egan Lecture Hall. And if you want to know more information about this World Affairs Council Forum with UAS, which goes from Thursday afternoon, the 23rd of October, through Saturday, early evening, the 25th of October, you can go to jwac.org and you can see the schedule there and also the bios of the presenters and speakers.
Annual event by the Juno World Affairs Council.
Yes.
Greg, you'll probably have a bumper crop of audience tomorrow night.
I hope so.
And I'm hoping a lot of people will come out to see the presentation by Living Voices Within the Silence this evening.
Yes.
Katie, thanks so much for keeping us posted on what's going on at UAS.
Okay.
Exciting place to be for the next 2 weeks.
Yes. Thank you, Pat.
Care supports the whole family, offering massage therapy, prenatal, birth and postpartum support, well woman care, and community classes. An advanced nurse practitioner now offers a variety of services to women of all ages to help meet health care needs. All insurances, including Aetna and Medicaid, are accepted. Discounted services are available for those who qualify. For an appointment or more information, contact the Juneau Family Health and Birth Center at 586-1203.
This is Bird Note. Migrating waterfowl rest in a plunge pool in the Grand Coulee of eastern Washington State at the base of a massive dry waterfall five times wider than Niagara Falls. The pool lies amidst a landscape like no other in the world. Here you find 100-ton boulders scattered across the land, gorges 1,000 feet deep, and enormous potholes. The origin of these channeled scablands, until recently, remained a mystery. But persistent geologists and photographs from Earth-observing satellites revealed their secret. During the last ice age, a lobe of the ice sheet covering western Canada dammed the Clark Fork River, creating a vast lake in what is now northwestern Montana. Several times during the past 15,000 years, the ice dam broke, sending hundreds of cubic miles of water roaring across the inland northwest and down the Columbia River Gorge. At bottlenecks in the gorge, floodwaters piled up 1,000 feet high, and some rivers briefly flowed uphill. Now, on this quiet, sunny October day, pintails and gadwalls bathe and preen in a pool created by one of the greatest floods the Earth has ever known. Today's show brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It's 22 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore hosting your Juneau Afternoon program today. Among the arts and culture events that are on this weekend is Woosh Canadier's fourth Grand Slam poetry event, and KTOO's Scott Burton attended last year. He brings us a little preview now of this year's event.
When I won't be taken captive by the social or political, I promise to dream every night, every morning, wake up willful, letting my mind mix up the silence with the whispers of a creative God. And I'm because love, hope, peace, justice, freedom don't mean anything if they're only poetry.
Ziggy, a.k.a. Guy Unsicker, was on fire in 2013's Grand Slam, and it paid off.
The winner for Woosh Canadier's third Grand Slam champion.
Ziggy Unsicker!
That announcement was made to a full house at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center after hours of powerful performances. Filling an auditorium with creative energy is just what co-founder Kristi Nami Erickson was after when she created the arts nonprofit.
We wanted to start Woosh Canadier, and we didn't have a name for it at the time. It was just Juneau Poetry Slam, you know, just to create a safe space that was open to teach people about what spoken word is and how it could be good for them as individuals and good for us as a community.
Poets have been performing at monthly open mics and poetry slams throughout the year, and winners from those events compete in this evening's Grand Slam. Among them is Nathan Block, who says his poetry
always starts off with some egotistical idea and then shows how we need to break those down in order to rise to the occasion of solidarity.
You can become divine by holding up the other, for the highest good of all others, where the only other to be continued should be for the other's good. Who urges me?
Block was a strong contender in 2013, but lost valuable points for exceeding a time limit in an early round.
Which your children will never read in their textbooks because all the good information was secretly sent to the moons of Neptune via satellites designed to look like shooting stars where Imperial Guards are marching around your thoughts.
After pieces by several opening performers, Block will compete against four fellow poets: David Parrish, M.D. Christensen, Max Suzuki, and Bill Merck. The event begins at 7 p.m. at the Juno Arts and Culture Center, and there will be food, non-alcoholic beverages, music, and a cake to celebrate Wooshke's 4th birthday.
So it's 25 minutes after 3 o'clock, and my next guest is here to tell us about an event which is coming up, not just right this instant, but fairly soon. And I think what's important here is that there's a set of rehearsals, and a lot of people are invited to these, right? Sally Smith, my guest.
This is an open invitation to sing.
Yeah.
So the first rehearsal is a week from Sunday. Okay. This is Holiday Pops. I call it, informally, a pickup chorus. You know?
Like a pickup band.
Yeah, yeah, okay, you know, you right. Just you get together and in one sense you jam, but actually you're focused on an end product, which is a gift to the people of Juneau.
So this is the Holiday Pops concert. It's going to be December 13th at Chapel by the Lake, and then it'll repeat again on December 14th at the Jack.
Correct.
But you're starting rehearsals the end of next week, right?
We are, the 26th of October, and the first rehearsal is at Northern Light United Church from 3 to 5:30 that Sunday afternoon. We have music packets ready to go. We have compact discs for alto, tenor, and bass, so people who don't read music and don't have the melody can learn their part aside from the rehearsals so that they can really take part and not worry about reading music. If you like to sing, this is the place
you
for
can pick it up right off the CD and sing just like you knew how to read the tenor line.
That's right.
Yeah.
Where's the tenor line? We don't
where's
care.
Where's the bass line, which is in that other darn clef down there on the bottom of that weird number on it?
That's right.
I never learned to read that because I played sax in school. And I sing baritone.
Well, come
and,
on over.
Oh, yeah, I'll be there. I can't get to the first rehearsal, but I'll be at the second one. Is that okay?
That is truly okay.
Okay, good. That's
truly,
that was going to be my first
okay.
question to you. Okay.
No, we are really looking for people who like to sing. It's informal. There is no audition. I won't say that, gee, you come if you can't carry a tune. I personally believe almost everybody can carry a tune, and I'm sorry when they've been told.
I don't know how that rumor got started.
Some teachers didn't give a kid a chance to mature,
yeah,
you
yeah,
know?
There you go.
But most can sing, and
yeah.
This is a good place to get some voice lessons, get some music background. The first half of this concert is all secular music, so we start off with a thing, a medley of holiday songs, Let It Snow and Sleigh Ride. And then we go into White Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
We have guests this year. We have the Miss Ain't Behavin' Trio.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
They're wonderful. So they'll do two pieces in that secular section. And we'll close off with everybody's holiday favorite, Twas the Night Before Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just that, you know, feel-good feeling. The second half is going to be the sacred section,
okay.
And we sing a couple of lullabies. Then Miss Ain't Behavin' will be back with a couple of sacred songs.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a very special item this year. Veterans for Peace brought us a little vignette that requires four men to read letters they're writing home.
Hmm.
And it's interspersed with Christmas carols, but the purpose behind it is this is the 100th anniversary of the Christmas Eve truce in World War I.
Wow.
So it's quite a moving piece of when the British and the Germans crossed the trenches and shared 24 hours of ceasefire with each other and sang carols,
mm-hmm.
And we will commemorate that. And then we get to close off the concert being joined by a brass quintet.
Wow.
So we will, and it's brass and chorus together. I think everybody wants to be a part of this, whether they're audience or singer, but we are right now.
There's not going to be anybody sitting out front.
Well, we're inviting singers to come join us. And Sundays will be rehearsals at Northern Light United Church starting October 26th. Tuesdays will be at Glacier Valley Elementary School from 7 to 9:15. I want to thank particularly Juno Lyric Opera for being the annual sponsor. I'm so honored to be a part of this organization. This is a Christmas gift to the community. The artistic team has donated their time, and the ticket prices are geared to cover our expenses only. They are not a fundraiser. So truly, we look at it as a gift to the community. Then I want to say how proud I am and pleased that we have Lori Heggie on keyboard. For anybody who doesn't know Lori, she's Juno Alaska Music Matters and a highly decorated teacher. Yeah. But to have her at the keyboard is...
Lori is amazing.
It is. Yeah. She's putting on gloves.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Hey, this is terrific. So let's get the dates again, and then I need one more thing. So basically at 3 to 5:30 Sunday afternoon at Northern Lights United Church.
Starting on the 26th.
On the 26th of October, next Sunday afternoon.
Right.
And then the second part of the rehearsals are 7 to 9:15 on Tuesday nights, and those are going to be held at Glacier Valley Elementary.
That's correct.
Okay, and basically you show up. You don't have to do now, what if somebody had a question or like me was wondering what would happen if you couldn't make the first rehearsal? Who would they call?
You can call 586-ARIA, A-R-I-A, which is Juno Lyric Opera.
Yeah, okay.
Or just come to the next rehearsal.
Yeah, just show up at the next one, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We will have packets of music at each rehearsal that you can... sign out. Okay. Now, there's no fee to sing. This isn't a workshop. We do invite people to help us defray the cost of the music.
Okay.
And that is a donation.
Right.
So there.
And of course, the sopranos will bring snacks the first night.
Absolutely.
The tenors will bring. I know how this works.
Oh, I like this a lot.
Yeah, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, snacks.
Well, I want people to understand you don't have to have a solo voice to sing in a chorus.
Yeah.
And the more people are in the chorus, the more mellow the sound. That's what we're looking for.
Yeah. Hey, this is terrific. And then the two performances are December 13th at Chapel by the lake and December 14th at the Jack. And so those are the two big nights when and do you have to get all dressed up to be in the chorus when you do this?
No. Chorus dress, we've been doing all black.
Okay.
Whatever you have, it's black.
Find
I don't
some
care
black
if it's
stuff.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah,
and then
okay.
we decorate you ourselves.
Terrific. Hey, this is like I love this about Juno. You know, we're isolated out here and sometimes you think that there's nothing going on and then you realize that we've made it ourselves. And we're going to do it ourselves. And that's just the spirit of this town.
It
an
is.
An amazing deal. Sally, thank you so much.
Thank
I understand you,
Pat.
You come back to us for this little thing from elsewhere now, right? Is this an annual
this
pilgrimage
is,
of yours?
This is the seventh year we've done this. We didn't know how long it would last. But the first year we had 48 on the risers. The second year we had 58. And then we had 68. I think we got as high as 72.
Uh-huh.
So...
well,
we hope to run close
to
70.
We can break that this year. Come on out, folks. Show up October 26th, 3 o'clock at Northern Lights United Church. Bring your voice and come on out and sing this stuff and get yourself ready for a concert on the 13th and 14th of December.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 17th of October. 2014. It was on this date in 1604 in Prague, Johannes Kepler witnessed the last supernova observed in the Milky Way. He knew the night sky very well and was surprised to see a very bright object in the western sky one night. He thought maybe it was the birth of a star, but a supernova is actually an explosion that signals the star's death. He studied it in earnest. He recorded observations of it for more than a year. It was so bright that it was visible during the day for 3 weeks. All of Kepler's observations were made by the naked eye. The telescope was not invented for a few more years. And although astronomers have since observed several supernovae in other galaxies, This one is the last observed by the naked eye in our own galaxy, the Milky Way. It was close to the center of the spiral galaxy, less than 20,000 light years away from us. It's the birthday of the playwright Arthur Miller, born New York City in 1915. Family owned a garment factory, and they lived in some comfort, had a big apartment and a summer home, but lost their money in the Depression, had to move into a decrepit house in Brooklyn on the same street as several aunts and uncles, including Arthur Miller's uncle, Manny Newman, who was a salesman, a loud, arrogant man who always made fun of Arthur Miller because his own sons were more handsome and athletic than Arthur was. Arthur Miller was 33 years old when he wrote Death of a Salesman, spent 6 weeks writing the play, and the character Willie Loman was based on his Uncle Manny. It's the birthday of Nathaniel West, born Nathan Weinstein in New York City, 1903. He was managing a hotel in New York City when he met a woman who wrote an advice column for the paper, who showed him some of the letters she'd gotten from readers. She thought that he would find them funny, but he was heartbroken how desperate and sad these people were. And he wrote his first novel, Miss Lonely Hearts, about an advice columnist overwhelmed by the sadness of the people who write to him. It's the birthday of Jimmy Breslin, born in New York, 1930, novelist, newspaper reporter, Jimmy Breslin, who said, "All the news business starts with your feet. In New York City, no story happens below the fourth floor." And it's the anniversary of the Loma Prieta earthquake in San Francisco, 1989, which took place during the warm-up to Game 3 of the World Series between the Oakland A's and the San Francisco Giants. Here's a poem for today by Michael Blumenthal entitled Six Cheerful Couplets on Death. "Most things won't happen," Larkin said, "but this one will, we will be dead. The saddest thing in each context is knowing that we could be next. Some take the bus, some take the train, some die in sleep, the rest in pain. But of one thing we can be sure, all die imperfect, each impure. Some wishing that they had been better, others worse, but no one deader. Shoes left like Buddhists at the door, those won't be needed anymore." Michael Blumenthal's Six Cheerful Couplets on Death, from his collection No Hurry, Poems 2000-2012, published by Etruscan Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 22 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Little Alaska Day music here.
Stars of gold on a field of blue, Alaska's flag, may it mean to you, the blue of the sea, the evening sky, those mountain lakes with the flowers nearby, the gold of the early light, our those dreams, that precious gold of the hills and the brilliant stars in the northern sky, the Bear, the Dipper, and shining bright, that great North Star with its steady light.
or land and sea, a beacon bright. Alaska's flag to Alaskans dear, the simple flag of the last frontier. A simple flag of a
Happy Day, Alaska. Okay, so it's 20 minutes before 4 o'clock. A quick announcement here. There will be a public lecture at the Juneau Centennial Hall in the Hickel Room tonight, and that'll be from 8 to 9 p.m. Raymond Roland, who is an aquaculture specialist and part of the Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program, will be talking about growth of shellfish aquaculture in Alaska, and a little bit about successful Alaska-based farming practices through 23 years of research and experience, the economic impacts of farming on local communities, and introducing a training program that's offered through the aquaculture program that's sponsored by the University of Alaska Sea Grant Marine Advisory Program. So that's tonight, 8 to 9 p.m., Juneau Centennial Hall in the Hickel Room for Raymond Roland, who is the aquacultural specialist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Jeff Brown did a little earlier conversation with Susan Smith, so we'll hear that next.
You're tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. I'm talking with Susan M. Smith, who's a woodcarver and a maker of robots. She's got a show at the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council Gallery, and it's really got me going. I really appreciate her work. Susan, thank you for being in the station with me today.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, how did you get started in the world of art?
My earliest recollection, I was like 2 years old. Excuse me, and we were in church, and I guess I was fussing too much, so my mother handed me a pencil and a piece of paper, and I just started drawing, and it's just like, I was just amazed, you know, just something clicked then. So I've been doing art my whole life.
At what point did you take up wood carving?
Wood carving?
Seriously, not in church.
Oh, yeah. Seriously, I was about 17, and the reason I got into that is we used to get this magazine, and in it was an article on Ivan Denton. He was a wood carver down south, and I was just so struck with the idea of wood carving when I saw that article. So I just had to try it, and my first tries were complete failures. I didn't have any luck, and there wasn't a sharp knife to be had around the farm. I grew up on a farm in Pennsylvania. And so really, about 17, I met my now husband, who had a sharp jackknife. I always say I married him because he always had a sharp knife around, but I still have the horse I carved with that jackknife when I was 17. Yeah.
Your work that I saw in the Arts and Humanities Council Gallery consists of carvings out of bark. Can you describe that process? Where do you get your bark, and how easy is it to carve?
I started with bark. I was in Haines. I lived in Haines for like 25 years. And I used to carve in basswood. And it was just so expensive to buy it and have it shipped up here. So I just got to thinking, what's locally that I could try? So I just tried the bark, and I loved carving it. And I've never went back. I've always carved bark since then. And also, the driftwood hunting is really good up there, so I would carve driftwood, make things out of driftwood, too. So everything is what I could get locally and not have to ship in.
You like wildlife and also Santa figures.
Yeah, Santas, I don't even know how I got into that. I did carve some years ago, but I just started carving some out of bark, and then I was selling them through the Christmas store, which was in the Senate building at the time, and now they're in Skagway. So I wholesaled to them for years.
Yeah. How many do you think you've made?
Literally thousands. And because of the Santas, I also got, discovered, I guess you'd say, and a company down in Texas called House of Hatton hired me to design a car for them, and then they reproduced them. So for about 8 years I worked for them. So So I've had reproductions like all over the place. You just go on eBay and there's, you know, reproductions of my Santa Clauses.
How did you get started in robots?
Robots was inspired by the movie Robots, that animated movie. I don't know if it was DreamWorks did that. But I went to see that movie, and I get, you know, it doesn't take much to get me going in another direction. But all those robots were, like, made from junk, and it was, like, in the 40s, 50s, you know. I just really liked that style, so I just had to try it. I had to, like, I want to see if I can make robots out of junk, and that's just where it started. So that was, like, 2009.
Could you just describe some of the things you find and use in your artwork?
Well, I get it at, even when I go back east on vacation, I'm hunting for pieces, you know, in flea markets and antique stores, yard sales.
You've been doing this for years.
Yeah, since 2009 for the robots, yeah. But you wouldn't believe the cache I have of stuff. It's kind of overrunning my studio.
They're little electronic voltmeters and...
Yeah. That's kind of like my favorite. They're kind of evolving. If you go to the show, you can kind of see some of my more earlier primitive ones, and I'm kind of developing more a little detailed and getting kind of a style going now.
Silverware, like forks that are bent into odd shapes.
Yeah, I like to use those for arms and, you know, the tines for fingers.
How many robots do you think you've made?
Just about all the ones at the show, and I think I have like four still at the studio, and I've sold about four, so that's all since then. You know, that's 30, 32, around there. Not a whole lot. I just do them when I get a little tired of carving. I'll switch over and dink with a robot, and then back to carving again.
All your robots seem to have names. Do you think they get the name before you carve it, or does that come afterwards?
It comes afterwards, kind of what they look like when they're done.
And they range in size from maybe a foot and a half high to...
To that big one that I call SS-14. He's 5 foot tall. That's the one with the plasma. He has a plasma plate on his chest with the, like, the lightning bolts that you can touch and your finger follows it. Or it follows your finger, I should say. Yeah.
What's next?
I don't know. It's just always evolving. Like, you know, these robots were the latest. And I used to do a lot in driftwood, don't anymore. So, right now it's the time of year to do my Santas. Start doing Santas.
How long does it take you to do a typical Santa?
If it's a pretty basic one, about 2 days, 3 days. Yeah, because I do them out of the bark. And I've been carving for 40 years now, so it's kind of, it comes natural to me now.
I'm on the air with Susan M. Smith. She's got a show of artwork that relates to wood carvings and also robots at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council Gallery. Susan, thank you so much for being on the air with me today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Susan's art will be on display all this month over at the Juno Arts Council Gallery. So go over and take a look at the robots. A little look at the weather here. We're looking at tonight, the clouds will start forming over, and then it'll develop into rain late in the evening. Low tonight, probably around 40, with northwest winds about 10 to 20 miles per hour. Those will shift over to the southeast to 10 to 15 miles per hour later. Saturday, we're looking at rain. Saturday night, we're looking at rain. Sunday, rain is likely. Sunday night, rain. Monday, rain likely. Monday night, rain. And then Tuesday, cloudy, chance of rain. So next Tuesday, it starts to open up a little bit. Wednesday, cloudy, chance of rain. And Thursday, mostly cloudy with the chance of rain. So it devolves from rain to a chance of rain in the middle of next week. But for tonight and tomorrow and Sunday, looks like we're going to be a little rainy here in Juneau, which is pretty much the normal circumstance for us. I think we get used to it, don't you? Anyway. Let's take a listen to one of the Mudrooms presentations. Mudrooms is this ongoing wonderful event that happens once a month here through the winter months. It's going on this month, I believe. And this one was by Rebecca Brown. I'll let them introduce themselves.
So our last speaker before the intermission is Rebecca Braun. Rebecca came to Juneau 20 years ago for a summer job and has since made Alaska home. She has passed the time as a biologist, teacher, journalist, and most recently as an underemployed cancer patient. She is, or hopes to be again, an avid runner, hiker, and skier. She especially loves the outdoor adventures with her children, Rosie, age 12, and Alder, age 6. She is grateful to the community of Juneau for providing so much love and support.
So I was thinking about actually telling a story about the time I drove someone's yacht into an iceberg, but I thought, no, you know, we Alaskans have all done stupid things on the water. Besides, that's way too embarrassing. So instead, I was going to tell you a story that starts last June 2013. Remember when we had summer? It was actually, so it was hot enough that I was lying in bed in a tank top one night. It was so unheard of, but I think it saved my life. Because I flung my arm like this and found a lump. And I was like, oh, that's weird. I suppose I should have a doctor check it out. Thinking nothing. In fact, it was a knot of cancerous lymph nodes and the harbinger of stage 3 breast cancer. Needless to say, my life quickly turned upside down, and with the help of a bunch of friends, since I really was feeling totally overwhelmed, I executed a quick move to the Seattle area for treatment. So we moved to Bainbridge Island, which actually turns out to be less of an island than Juneau. You can drive off this island to the north onto the Olympic Peninsula, or from the south, you can take a 35-minute ferry ride to the heart of downtown Seattle, every 50 minutes between 4:45 a.m. and like 1:10 a.m. So I was like, pshaw, you guys, this is no island. But that said, my treatment began with chemotherapy. My typical chemo day began on the second floor of my cancer institute. And after the inevitable and, to my mind, just completely unforgivable and inexplicably long wait, I'd be called back and a nurse would access my port. That's short for porticath. It's sort of like a titanium button that they placed under the skin right here. And one side, the outside was kind of like a rubber pin cushion. And on the inside is attached to a catheter that would access my superior vena cava for maximum efficiency of delivery of the poison throughout my body. So when it's time to, you know, get my dose of poison, the nurse would punch through my skin, you know, with a needle and hoses like this, and then draw some blood. They had to test my blood and make sure I had enough white blood cells and red blood cells left to withstand another assault, because chemo drugs like to kill any fast-growing cells, which includes your white blood cells and your red blood cells and all that good stuff. So each time I found that, yes, my blood levels were very low, but not low enough that I couldn't have chemo. So, woohoo, I would do a little inner ironic cheer. I get more poison. So next I'd go upstairs to the fifth floor where my medical oncologist was, and I always took the stairs, just like I do in the Capitol building, only I had to pull my hand into my sleeve for the doorknobs because I'm not supposed to touch any germs due to my not having, like, no immune system. On the fifth floor, I would wait again, and then a nurse would finally get me. She'd take my vitals and read me a list of questions. What's your pain level? Any nausea or dizziness? Any mouth sores? Fatigue? And then my personal favorite, have you slipped or fallen this week? There's nothing like a visit to the oncology nurse to make you feel like a geriatric. And after another wait, I'd have a similar chat with my oncologist, and I'd pepper her with any questions I managed to dream up since the previous week. I'd ask her about supplements. I'd ask her about my schedule. I'd ask her about some study I read in France about linking circadian rhythms with chemotherapy. Anyway, she probably doesn't miss me. Finally, I'm given a yellow slip of paper that literally says, good to go, in capital letters on it. And I take that yellow slip of paper to the third floor, the infusion floor, and wave it at the people at the desk who would nod to me, and I would sit down to, I'm sure you can guess, wait, along with a very sorry group of humans. We sit and stare at the fish in the aquarium as we wait, or we try to get a piece into one of the impossible jigsaw puzzles. We have rubber hoses sticking out of our clothes, bandages on our hands, caps on our heads. Some of us lean on canes or walkers or our companions. Some smile and compliment each other's headwear, maybe even knit or flip through a magazine. It's a peaceful scene. Somehow, when one's faced with potential life-ending disease, the hurry fades. I had three chemo drugs, adriamycin and Cytoxan, were administered together first, and then 2 months of Taxol. Adriamycin is this bright red liquid I would call poison Kool-Aid, and it was so toxic that it can't get on your skin. I guess it'll just eat up your skin tissue. So the nurse would have to actually inject it herself after putting on gloves, a mask, and in one case, buttoning up her lab coat to the top. It was really comforting. But before they put the chemo down the chute, they have to throw down a bunch of stuff meant to help you survive the chemo. Decadron, Pepcid, Zofran, Benadryl. All this tends to make me a little loopy, and I'm probably pretty entertaining for my chemo buddy when I'm not dozing off. For each chemo visit, I have a buddy. For several, it was my boyfriend, Brian. Friends from Juno joined me for the others. My chemo buddy keeps me company through the wait, distracts me from the perturbing scene of the inbound poison, runs out to get my favorite quinoa from the cart across the street. And when I'm getting Taxol, my chemo buddy is my ice assistant. I iced my fingers and toes to try to prevent neuropathy. And most of all, my chemo buddy made it a party celebrating the ironies of cancer treatment, friendship, love, my will to live. I couldn't have done it without my chemo buddy. When it's all over, some 7-8 hours after it started, a nurse removes the gear from my port, and I walk 12, 13 blocks down to the ferry and return to Bainbridge. My mom once asked me, how long is that trip, thinking it must be so onerous. When I figured it out, it's probably about an hour and a half altogether, but there was nothing onerous about it. In fact, I quite enjoyed the rides on the ferry. I had occasional conversations on the boat, particularly while waiting to disembark when everybody gets squeezed before you go over the gangplank. I like your hat, is how these conversations usually began. Thank you, I'd say. Are you in treatment? They'd ask gently. Once after that hat entree, a woman told me that she too had had breast cancer. Now she said she has a bad heart. The chemo drugs ruined her heart, and she has a brain tumor. Good luck, we said to each other as we parted 3 seconds later. Another time after the same hat business, I said, just tell me your cancer story. A man told me about his 15-year-old daughter's leukemia, and he told me how difficult the treatment was and how brave she was. And I said, he shook his head, backing off, suddenly realizing this wasn't the time for me to hear cancer failure stories. I'm sorry, I said as we walked off. But most of all, I really didn't talk to people on the ferry. And I really liked how the ferry brought people together in this kind of peaceful way, not like in a car where you're in your own cell, locked in unspoken combat with everybody in their own cells. On the ferry, I mostly didn't talk to people. I didn't do much of anything. I sat there staring out the window, lying down on the long padded benches, just vegging out. I never even saw an orca. They're supposed to be all over Puget Sound. But these ferry rides were vital to my treatment. I guess it's kind of like sleep. It feels like nothing's happening, but apparently that's when our brain does all the work. The ferry was my portal between worlds. In the morning, I was a mom waving to my son as he boarded the school bus for kindergarten. Crossing the water, I entered a sick zone. I became a cancer patient. And on the return journey, I was cleansed of sickness, returned to an island of healing. On the water crossing over, I found the peace and serenity I needed to redefine myself as whole, healthy, human, healing. Thinking back, I realized we all need these empty spaces in our lives, the rest that makes the music's rhythm, the aloneness that makes connection possible, the ebb that makes the flow. So I'm thankful for lots of things, among them the Washington State Ferry. Thank you.
Rebecca Braun's incredible recitation of the story of her breast cancer, delivered at Mudrooms, a new Juno tradition over the last 3 years here. It's about a minute and a half before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska.
Disability myth. People with mental illness are violent and unpredictable. Fact. The vast majority of people who experience mental health needs are no more violent than anyone else. Mental illness affects almost every family in the United States. October is Disability Awareness Month. Know the facts, dispel the myths. This message brought to you by Juno Alliance for Mental Health and Southeast Alaska Independent Living.
Monday at 3, Scott Burton will be our host for Juno Afternoon. He'll be talking with the organizers for this year's Juno World Affairs Council's Fall Forum. We heard a little bit about that earlier today. Mexico, do fences make good neighbors? Corey Stennett will come in to highlight the upcoming workshop, Growing Up, All About Puberty. And he'll be talking with Kathleen McFerrin, a certified trainer with the Center for Nonviolent Communications, about her workshop that's coming up next weekend, Bringing the Communications Gap. So stay tuned for Juno Afternoon. This is KTOO in Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, it's K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, it's K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. And K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9.